And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's July 26th, the 207th day of the year. 158 days remain till the end of the year. Unless we get some congressional magic making, which is going on. I made mention yesterday of the fact that I had tried to work with Congresswoman Escobar's office, but you keep having to fill out privacy statements. I've got 3 open complaints. I just sent a 4th one, and I get an email today wanting me to fill out a 5th one. I have no idea what all that is about. But she's so busy being in solidarity with her sisters over abortion, she can't help the constituents who elected her. If she doesn't want the job, go sell shoes. Okay. Also, we have the monkeypox issue, which is a sexually transmitted disease. However, Fauci and his crew are saying, wear a mask. On what? My wife, who's about as liberal as they come, keeps asking that question, and nobody can answer it. And Fauci now says, well, maybe we have to wear a mask forever. But you got to wear the right kind of mask, an N95. Well, you know, this is a man who got the job because his wife was head of the NIH and all this, nepotism reared its ugly head. He's going to retire on a bigger pension than the president gets in salary. I find a problem with that. Well, on this day in 657, the first fitna in the Battle of Siffin, troops led by Ali ibn Abu Talib clashed with those led by Muawiyah I. 811, Battle of Pliska. Byzantine Emperor Nikephoros I is killed, and his heir, Astyochios, is seriously wounded. That's a good reason for the leaders not to lead from the front. 920, routed an alliance of Christian troops from Navarre and Leon against the Muslims at the Battle of Valdecunquera. 1309, Henry VII is recognized King of the Romans by Pope Clement V. God has spoken. 1509, the Emperor Krishna Devaraya ascends to the throne, marking the beginning of the regeneration of the Vijayanagara Empire. 1529, Francisco Pizarro Gonzalez, Spanish conquistador, is appointed governor of Peru. You steal it, you're the governor. 1579, Francis Drake, the English explorer, discovers a major bay on the coast of California. Today, we call that San Francisco. 1581, Plakat van Verlatingen, the Act of Abjuration. The northern Low Countries declared their independence from the Spanish King, Philip II. 1703, during the Bavarian Rumble, the rural population of Tyrol drove the Bavarian Prince Elector, Maximilian II, Emmanuel, out of North Tyrol with a victory at the Ponatzer Bridge and prevented the Bavarian army, which was allied with France, from marching as planned on Vienna during the War of Spanish Succession. Never underestimate country folk. 1745, the first recorded women's cricket match takes place near Guildford in England. 1758, French and Indian War, siege of Louisbourg, ends with British forces defeating the French and taking control of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. 1775, the office that would later become the United States Post Office Department is established by the Second Continental Congress. Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania takes office as Postmaster General. 1788, New York ratifies the U.S. Constitution, becomes the 11th state of the U.S. 1803, the Surrey Iron Railway, arguably the world's first public railway, opens in South London in the U.K. 1814, the Swedish-Norwegian War begins. 1822, Jose de San Martin arrives in Guayaquil, Ecuador to meet with Simon Bolivar. Also in 1822, the first day of the three-day Battle of Dervanakia between the Ottoman Empire force led by Mahmud Dramali Pasha and the Greek Revolutionary force led by Theodoros Kolokotronis. 1847, Liberia declared its independence. 1861, American Civil War. George B. McClellan assumes command of the Army of the Potomac following a disastrous Union defeat at the First Battle of Bull Run. McClellan was the most brilliant trainer the Union Army had, but he wasn't crap when it came to leading in the field. 1863, American Civil War. Morgan's raid ends at Salemville, Ohio. Confederate cavalry leader John Hunt Morgan and 360 of his volunteers are captured by Union forces. They couldn't get across the bridge. 1882, premiere of Richard Wagner's opera Parsifal at the Bayreuth. 1882, the Republic of Stellaland is founded in Southern Africa. 1887, publication of the Unua Libro, founding the Esperanto movement. 1890, Buenos Aires, Argentina, the Revolution del Parque takes place, forcing President Miguel Angel Juarez Celman's resignation. 1891, France annexes Tahiti. All those grass skirts. 1892, Dada Baha Naroji is elected the first Indian member of the Parliament in Britain. 1897, Anglo-Afghan War. The Pashtun Fakir Sadullah leads an army of more than 10,000 to begin a siege of the British garrison at the Malakan Agency in the northwestern frontier province of India. 1899, Ulysses Herero, the 27th President of the Dominican Republic, is assassinated on this date. 1908, U.S. Attorney General Charles Joseph Bonaparte issues an order to immediately staff the office of the Chief Examiner, that's later renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which became the permanent domain of J. Edgar Hoover. 1918, Emmy Noether's paper, which became known as Noether Theorem, is presented in Göttingen, Germany, from which conservation laws are deduced for symmetries of angular momentum, linear momentum, and energy. 1936, Spanish Civil War. Germany and Italy decide to intervene in the war in support of Francisco Franco and the nationalist faction. 1936, Edward VIII, in one of his few official duties before he abdicates the throne to run off with his sweetie, officially unveils a Canadian National Vimy Memorial. 1937, Spanish Civil War. End of the Battle of Brunette with a nationalist victory. 1941, World War II, Battle of Grand Harbor. British forces on Malta destroy an attack by the Italian Decima Flotiglia MAS. Fort St. Elmo Bridge covering the harbor is demolished in the process. 1941, World War II. In response to the Japanese occupation of French Indochina, the U.S., Britain, and the Netherlands freeze all Japanese assets and cut off oil shipments. 1945, they threaten to spank Tito. Japanese commander. 1944, World War II. The Red Army enters Lviv, major city in western Ukraine, capturing it from the Nazis. Only 300 Jews survived out of 160,000 living there prior to the occupation. 1945, the Labour Party wins the UK's general election of July 5th by a landslide, removing Winston Churchill from power. 1945, World War II, the Potsdam Declaration is signed in Potsdam, Germany. 1945, World War II, HMS Vestal is the last British Royal Navy ship to be sunk in the war. That's a title you don't want to have. 1945, World War II, the USS Indianapolis arrives in Tinian with components and enriched uranium for the Little Boy nuclear bomb. 1946, Aloha Airlines began service from Honolulu International Airport. 1947, Cold War. President Harry Truman signs the National Security Act of 47 into law, creating the Central Intelligence Agency, U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Air Force, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the U.S. National Security Council. There's a lot of rumor that what led to the creation of the the CIA and the Security Council was the crashed UFO in Roswell, which I used to speak at until His Lordship Don Smith took control. 1948, President Harry Truman signs Executive Order 9981, desegregating the military of the U.S. 1951, Walt Disney's 13th animated film, Alice in Wonderland, premieres in London, England. 1952, King Farouk of Egypt abdicates in favor of his son Fuad. 1953, Cold War, Fidel Castro leads an unsuccessful attack on the Moncada barracks, which begins the Cuban Revolution. The movement took the name of the date, the 26th of July movement. 1953, Arizona Governor John Howard Pyle orders an anti-polygamy law enforcement crackdown on residents of Short Creek, Arizona, which comes known as the Short Creek Raid. 1953, soldiers from the 2nd Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment, repel a number of Chinese assaults against a key position known as the Hook during the Battle of Samachan River, just hours before the armistice agreement is signed, ending the Korean War. 1956, following the World Bank's refusal to fund building the Aswan Dam, Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, sparks international condemnation. 1957, Carlos Castillo Amas, dictator of Guatemala, is assassinated. 1958, Explorer program Explorer 4 is launched. 1963, SINCOM 2, the world's first geosynchronous satellite, is launched from Cape Canaveral on a Delta B booster. 1963, an earthquake in Skopje, Yugoslavia, present-day North Macedonia, leaves 1,100 people dead. 1963, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development votes to admit Japan. 1968, Vietnam War, South Vietnamese opposition leader Thorong Dinh Zhu is sentenced to 5 years hard labor for advocating the formation of a coalition government as a way to move toward an end to the war. Turns out he was right, but that's what's being right among friends. 1971, Apollo program, launch of Apollo 15 on the first Apollo J mission and the first use of the lunar roving vehicle. 1974, Greek Prime Minister Konstantinos Karamanis forms the country's first civil government after 7 years of military rule. 1977, the National Assembly of Quebec imposes the use of French as the official language in the provincial government. That made a lot of people unhappy. 1989, a federal grand jury indicts Cornell University student Robert Morris Jr. for releasing the Morris worm. He was the first person to be prosecuted under the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The Morris worm, also known as the Internet worm, on November 2, 1988, was one of the oldest computer worms distributed through the Internet and the first to gain significant mainstream media attention. Written by a graduate student at Cornell, Robert Tappan Morris, and launched November 2, 1988 from the computer system of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And I just got some interesting news. Tony Dow from Leave It to Beaver died at age 77. I'm sure the beaver's broken up. Morris said he created the worms to see if it could be done, and was released from the MIT in the hope of suggesting that its creators studied there instead of Cornell. He did become a tenured professor at MIT in 2006. He was a son of Robert Morris, a cryptographer who at the time was working for the NSA. This worm exploited several vulnerabilities to get entry to targeted systems, including a hole in the debug mode of the Unix sendmail program, a buffer overflow or overrun hole in the fingered network service, and a transitive trust enabled by people setting up network logins with no password requirements through a remote execution with remote shell. It also exploited weak passwords. Most people used 1234. Okay, let's see what else we got. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, signed into law by President George H.W. Bush. And I can tell you of experience, that law is absolutely worthless. Everybody ignores it. 1993, Asiana Airlines Flight 733 crashes into a ridge on Mount Ungao on its third attempt to land at Mokpo Airport in South Korea. 68 of the 116 people on board are killed. 1999, Kargil conflict officially comes to an end. The Indian Army announces the complete eviction of Pakistani intruders. Now, the Kargil conflict was an armed conflict fought between India and Pakistan. It went from May to July 1999 in the Kargil district of Jammu in Kashmir and elsewhere along the lines of control in India. The Indian Air Force's role in this was acting jointly with the Indian Army ground troops during the war. It was aimed at fleshing out regular and irregular troops of the Pakistan Army from vacated Indian positions along the line of control. This particular operation got the code name Operation Safed Shagar. All right. In 2005, Space Shuttle Program, STS-114 mission, launch of Discovery, NASA's first scheduled flight mission after the Columbia disaster in 2003. If you remember, that's the one that blew up. Supposedly done by Russian laser cannons. 2005, Mumbai, India, receives 99.5 centimeters of rain within 24 hours. That's 39.17 inches. Results in floods that killed over 5,000 people. 2008, 56 people were killed and over 200 are injured in the Ahmedabad bombings to India, in India. 2009, the militant Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram attacks a police station in Bauchi, leading to reprisals by the Nigerian police force and 4 days of violence across multiple cities. 2011, a Royal Moroccan Air Force Lockheed C-130 Hercules clashes near Guilmin Airport in Guilmin, Morocco. All 80 people on board are killed. 2016, the Sagamihara stabbings occur in Kanagawa Prefecture in Japan. 19 people are killed. Also in 2016, Hillary Clinton becomes the first female nominee for President of the United States by a major political party at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Wonder how many she paid off to get that. 2016, Solar Impulse 2 becomes the first solar-powered aircraft to circumnavigate the Earth. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances, Christian Feast Day, Andrew of Fu Yin, Anne in Western Christianity, Bartolomeo Capitanio, Blessed Maria Perina, Joachim in Western Christianity, Parascavia of Rome in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Venera, Day of National Significance in Barbados, Day of the National Rebellion in Cuba, Esperanto Day, Independence Day in Liberia, celebrates independence of Liberia from the American Colonization Society in 1847, and the Maldives Independence Day, celebrates independence of Maldives from the UK in 1965. And in India, it's Kargil Victory Day, or Kargil Vijay Diwas. Alrighty, let's see what else we got. Alrighty. In 811, the Battle of Pliska. Bulgarians under Krum beat Byzantines. 1920, the rout of an alliance of Christian troops from Navarre and Leon against the Muslims at Pamplona. 1267, the Inquisition forms in Rome under Pope Clement IV. You don't believe the way we tell you to believe, you're going to die. 1469, War of the Roses, Battle of Edgecott Moor, pitting the forces of Richard Neville, 16th Earl of Warwick, against those of King Edward IV, my ancestor. 1497, Edward IV's son, Perkin Warbeck's army, lands in Cork. 1499, Spanish conquistador Alonso de Ojeda discovers Curacao Islands. 1519, Francisco Pizarro gets a royal charter for the west coast of South America. 1524, James V, the King of Scotland, is declared fit to govern by the Scottish Parliament at age 12. 1533, Francisco Pizarro orders the death of the last Sapa Inca emperor, Atahualpa. 200 conquistadors conquered an empire of 10 million. Some of the most deadly warriors South America had ever seen. 1576, Multende Spanish troops conquer at least. 1588, English Admiral Sir John Hawkins knighted for his actions against the Armada. 1609, English mathematician Thomas Harriot is the first person to draw a map of the moon by looking at it through a telescope. 1656, Dutch painter Rembrandt van Rijn declares he's insolvent. That means he doesn't have any money. 1663, French troops invade Papal territory, Comtat Venetian. 1678, England and Netherlands sign a treaty, sending an ultimatum to France. 1755, adventurer, writer, and famous lover Giacomo Casanova is arrested in Venice for an affront to religion and common decency and imprisoned in the Doge's palace. 1758, the British battle fleet under General James Wolfe conquers Louisbourg. 1759, 11,000 British troops drive a token French garrison of 400 out of Fort Ticonderoga, New York. 1790, Congress passes the Funding Act of 1790, making the federal government responsible for the debts incurred by the states. All they did is tax the citizens. 1805, Naples, Calabria, struck by earthquake, 26,000 die. 1832, HMS Beagle anchors in Montevideo. 1835, the first sugarcane plantation started in Hawaii. 1847, Moses Garish Farmer builds the first miniature train for children to ride. 1858, Baron Lionel de Rothschild becomes the first Jewish person elected to the British Parliament. 1864, there's a riot at McCook's, the Lovejoy Station in Georgia. 1864, the Battle of Ezra Church in Georgia. That was Hood's third sortie. 1865, Patrick Francis Healy is the first African-American awarded a Ph.D. from the University of Leuven in Belgium. I was going to University of Texas at El Paso, and I asked, I got my fifth degree. I asked for entry into the Ph.D. program, and I was told that I was denied because I was a danger to the university, because they knew from my VA medical records that I was a Vietnam veteran trained in combat and prone to violence. In fact, they used to have armed security follow me around. Whenever I was bored, I'd look at one of them and go, boo, and they'd run. 1865, the capital of New Zealand moves from Auckland to Wellington. 1866, Canoe Club opens in England. 1878, in California, poet and American West outlaw Black Bart makes his last clean getaway when he steals a safe box from a Wells Fargo stagecoach. Empty box is found later with a poem inside. 1881, French Marines occupy Tunisian harbor city Safax. Vitascope Hall, the first permanent for-profit movie theater, opens in New Orleans. 1903, Horatio Nelson Jackson, Sewell K. Crocker, and a bulldog named Bud complete the first automobile trip across the U.S., San Francisco to New York, in a two-cylinder Winston. Only took them 63 days, 12 hours, and 30 minutes. They had to stop and let the dog do his business, you know. 1914, First Lord of the Admiralty, that's the British Minister of the Navy, Winston Churchill, orders the British fleet to remain. 1914, for the next 2 days, the foreign ministers and the leaders of major states worked feverishly to avert war. Didn't work. 1914 also saw Irish volunteers unload a shipment of 1,500 rifles and 45,000 rounds of ammunition, which arrived from Germany aboard Erskine Childers' yacht, the Ashguard. British troops fired on a jeering crowd on Bachelor's Walk in Dublin, killed three citizens, and the fun began. 1916, the U.S. protests the blacklist issued by the British forbidding trade with some 30 U.S. firms. And in 1917, on this date, the man himself, J. Edgar Hoover, got a job in the U.S. Department of Justice, went on to become king, and him and Lyndon Johnson took down John Kennedy. Got a new book coming out on that. With some information it's never seen in light of day before. All right. There's been a lot of discussion about the Warren Commission and Jim Garrison's investigation, and you know the federal government's had an answer for everything, but. Since I was 10 years old and I watched the assassination, I've been fascinated. Because, excuse me, some of the things the government said could not be true. Interestingly enough, Jesse Ventura, who I've interviewed on this show a number of times, wrote a book called They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. And he makes a very solid case. And if you ever read Richard Belzer's book called Hit List, a lot of people involved peripherally in assassination mysteriously died. And let's not forget Arlen Specter and his magic bullet that turned different directions in the air to produce seven wounds. That had the magic bullet had to exist for the government's case to be solid. Then we've got Hale Boggs, who was going to do something about the FBI sticking its nose into everything. And he vanished on a campaign trip in Alaska. Never found hiding a hair of him. You know, a lot of people think Jim Garrison was a true American hero. He was the New Orleans district attorney in 1966. And he uncovered evidence believed to be linked to the assassination of Kennedy and opened an official investigation into those facts. He said, we're legally obligated to pursue them. And it was within their legal jurisdiction and could have and should have been pursued without obstructions of justice by anybody. And in fact, a lot of the American population welcomed the district attorney's investigation because it, after the farce that was called the Warren Commission, it was the first authentic look at what had happened. And it was widely perceived that finally there's going to be an actual serious investigation. Garrison went on the Steve Allen Show in 1971. And he explained that a lot of what the government had said about the assassination through the Warren Commission, and we're still being lied to, even though it was, 59 years ago? Next year it'll be 60. Justice was obstructed, there's no question about it. It was obstructed by the very people supposed to be guarding our rights to learn the truth. And it's now known what the U.S. government did to interfere with Garrison's investigation. Now, Garrison claimed the CIA was trying to stop him, and nobody believed him, of course. Then former CIA official Victor Marchetti revealed that high-level CIA conferences in the early 1969 determined to give help in the trial. And Marchetti said that he knew they didn't mean help Garrison. Both Clay Shaw and David Ferry, another of the suspects that Garrison was investigating, had been employed by the CIA at one time. In fact, the wheels of power in the U.S. government impeded the investigation at every opportunity. They bugged his office. They smeared his name. They blocked extradition of witnesses that he tried to get when they fled to other states. His attempts to subpoena witnesses were struck down by judges. And then the major media, those protectors of the American way and truth, justice, and all that other good stuff, went after him. They launched a vicious, well-organized attempt to undercut his investigation. So you have to ask yourself at this point, why did the U.S. government block Jim Garrison's court case? I mean, he was a legitimate district attorney pursuing what was a local case. You know, it was a murder case, so there's no statute of limitations. He got to decide, did he prosecute or not? And if he wanted to go after the case, why were subpoenaed witnesses stopped by the federal government? I mean, that point alone shows a government cover-up and government malfeasance to the worst degree. They worked against District Attorney Garrison's trial. They'd come from the highest echelons of government. And who makes the call to block a local DA? The Attorney General? Maybe the President? It's not going to be some mid-level guy making a call and overruling a legitimate local district attorney. And although the jury found there was not sufficient evidence to convict Clay Shaw, who was the defendant in the trial, Garrison did prove a lot of important points that the government didn't want to see the light of day. He found strong assassination links to mobster Carlo Marcello's associate David Ferry, Guy Bannister, and Jack Ruby. Turns out Ruby and Oswald knew each other well. They'd both been in CIA training camps together. He also proved Oswald's intelligence linkage. His investigation found Shaw linked to a subterranean world of anti-Castro operations involving a plot in Maryland, that involved a strange pilot and paramilitarist named David Ferry and a rabid John Birch Society member and ex-FBI agent named Guy Bannister. Newly released government files, plus the results of digging by researchers William Davey, Peter Vey, and Jim DiEugenio, indicate that Oswald was frequently seen with Shaw, Ferry, and Bannister. 1995, Lou Ivan, an investigator for Garrison, told Davey that in February 1967, he met with a very frightened David Ferry, who admitted doing contract work for the CIA and who knew Oswald and Shaw. 4 days after he told Ivan that Shaw worked for the CIA and he hated Kennedy, Ferry was dead. Two unsigned suicide notes were found next to the body, but the autopsy said a brain aneurysm was the cause of the death. Now, you can, in fact, cause a brain aneurysm. Now, Garrison investigated Oswald's background more tenaciously and much more thorough than did the Warren Commission. Former FBI Special Agent William Turner, who'd worked with the Garrison investigation, also shared some interesting revelations in something he wrote that detailed his experiences about the investigation. The article was called The Garrison Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy. And it really went in depth on what they knew and how they knew it. According to an excerpt, Garrison believes Oswald was schooled in covert operations by the CIA while in the Marine Corps at the Atsugi Naval Station in Japan. That was a U-2 facility. Interestingly, two possibly relevant documents, Oswald's access to information about the U-2 and a reproduction of a CIA official dossier on Oswald, are still classified in the National Archives. It was 59 years ago, people. Curiously, the miscast Marine, who was constantly in hot water, had a crypto clearance on top of a top secret clearance and was given two electronic courses. According to Garrison, it was odd that even though he supposedly defected to the Soviet Union with top secret data on their radar nets, absolutely no action was taken against him when he came back to the U.S. And there's a lot of evidence, to include an eyewitness, that the man that came back was not the man that went. One of Garrison's major finds was Dean Andrews, a flashy Southern attorney who was an established link between Lee Harvey Oswald and Clay Shaw. Andrews knowingly concealed the fact that Clay Bertrand was an alias for Clay Shaw, who, it has been proven, had ties to U.S. intelligence. And the government clearly intimidated Dean Andrews into changing his testimony. But the CIA itself proved that Shaw was with the agency. In fact, the CIA has admitted that. Memorandums on a number of the figures in Garrison's probe were prepared in 67 and 68 for the deputy director of plans. Turns out Garrison and Marchetti were right. The CIA verified Shaw's background in an April 6, 1967 file for the deputy chief's security research staff. But bear in mind, this is what researchers dug up later. At the time, when Garrison was trying to conduct an authentic investigation, he was stonewalled every step of the way, and make no mistake about it, the government lied and said there was no connection between Shaw and the CIA. Now, there's an online clip on YouTube where you can see what a colorful character Dean Andrews was. That was the jive talking to Orland's attorney who John Candy portrayed so well in Oliver Stone's film JFK. That was one of the many hatchet jobs done on the Garrison investigation in the press. Garrison documented a conversation between him and Andrews for his book On the Trail of the Assassins. For the film JFK, it was depicted almost verbatim. Now, Garrison said, if you lie to the grand jury, you've been lying to me, I'm going to charge you with perjury. Am I getting through to you? When Andrews said, is this off the record, Daddy-O? Garrison nodded, and he said, in that case, let me sum it up for you real quick. Simple as this. If I answer that question you keep asking me, if I give you the name you keep trying to get, then it's goodbye, Dean Andrews. It's bon voyage, Dino. I mean like permanent. I mean like a bullet in my head, which makes it hard to do one's legal research if you get my drift. That help you see my problem a little better? Garrison said, read my lips. Either you dance into the grand jury with the real Monica of that cat who called you to represent Lee Oswald, or your fat behind's going to the slammer. Do you dig me? Andrews responded, do you have any idea what you're getting into, my man? You want to dance with the government? Is that what you want? Then be my guest. You'll get sat on, and I do mean hard. But the government torpedoed that witness, and Garrison knew it. He said it in his book. He said it had become readily apparent to me. The more Andrews realized that his having received a phone call to defend Lee Oswald was a potential danger to him, the foggier the identity of Clay Bertrand became in his mind. By the time Andrews appeared before the Warren Commission in July 1964, Bertrand's height had shrunk from 6'2" all the way down to 5'8". And apparently, in response to subtle pressure from FBI agents, Andrews told him, write what you want, that I'm nuts. I don't care. And the agents obligingly wrote in their final report. Andrews had come to the conclusion that the phone call from Bertrand had been a figment of his imagination. That not only allowed the Bureau to conclude its investigation into Andrews, but harmonized with its announced conclusion, Lee Oswald accomplished Kennedy's assassination alone and unaided. A lone nut gunman beat the best security the Secret Service could produce for its president. and he proved that the Warren Commission altered witness testimony. Another important witness whom the Garrison investigation found was Julia Ann Mercer. Some of the best witnesses to the assassination found a way to us after it became apparent to them federal agents and the Dallas police really weren't interested in what they saw. Julia Ann Mercer was just such a witness. In fact, no other witness so completely eliminated that for Garrison to the extent of the cover-up. Mercer had been but a few feet away from when one of the riflemen was unloaded at the grassy knoll shortly after, before the arrival of the motorcade. Consequently, she was a witness not only to the preparation of Kennedy's murder, but also the conspiracy involved. She gave statements to the FBI and the Dallas Sheriff's Office and returned to the FBI and provided additional statements, but she was never called by the Warren Commission. She wasn't even asked to provide an affidavit. Quite contrary to the attempted smear job done on her by author Gerald Posner in his book, Case Closed, Julia Ann Mercer was a sophisticated woman and a very credible witness. Garrison was surprised when he met her. He said, one day in early 1968, her husband called me at the office, said he and his wife were in New Orleans on business and had some things to tell him. And I agreed to meet him at the Fairmont Hotel where they were staying. Garrison said, arriving at their suite, I found the most impressive couple, mid-aged man of obvious substance. He'd been a Republican member of Congress from Illinois. Equally impressive, she was intelligent, well-dressed, the kind of witness any lawyer would love to have testifying on his side in front of a jury. Miss Mercer's statements were definitely altered, and she showed up to Garrison in precise terms. After he departed on business, Garrison handed her copies of her statement that had been printed in the Warren Commission exhibits. And she read them carefully and then shook her head and said, these have been altered. He had me saying just the opposite of what I really told him. It's not at all surprising that Mercer's testimony was a threat to the cover-up. She was an eyewitness to an amazing event, and her recollection was absolutely positive. She said about an hour before the assassination, she'd been driving west on Elm Street and had been stopped just past the grassy knoll by traffic congestion. To her surprise, because she recalled the president's parade was coming soon, she saw a young man in a pickup truck to her right dismount carrying a rifle, making no effort to conceal it. In any kind of cover of some sort, she observed him walk up the grassy hill, which forms part of the overpass, looked at the driver several times, got a good look at his face and brown face and brown eyes, and he looked right back at her. She also observed that three police officers standing near her motorcycle on the overpass above her and just ahead. And she recalled they showed no curiosity about the young man climbing the side of the grassy knoll with a rifle in his hands. So, it's amazing. You know, we'd think the U.S. government would actually welcome upstanding citizens spending their own time to testify about an important event that they witnessed, but that's not the case. After the assassination, when Mercer sought to make this information available to law enforcement, the response was almost frenzied. At the FBI office, where she went the day after the assassination, she was shown a number of mugshots, and among several she selected as resembling the driver was a photograph of Jack Ruby. On Sunday, when she saw Ruby kill Oswald on TV, she positively recognized him as the driver of the pickup truck and notified the FBI office. Nevertheless, the FBI altered her statement so it didn't note she had made a positive identification. King Hoover didn't want that. She laughed when she pointed that out. To Garrison, she said, see, the FBI made it just the opposite of what I really said. Then she said, he was only a few feet away from me. How could I not recognize Jack Ruby when I saw him shoot Oswald on TV? Well, not only did the feds alter her statement, so did the Dallas police. Clearly, the Dallas police did not want anybody to know the truth. Dallas Sheriff's Office went through the same laborious fraud and added an imaginative touch of its own. Although the Mercer had never been brought before any notary, the Sheriff's Office filed a sworn affidavit stating she didn't identify the driver, although she might if I see him again, and significantly changed the number of other facts. And she pointed to something on the form and asked Garrison if he saw that notarized statement signature. She said, that's not my signature. I signed my name with a big A like this. She produced a pen and wrote her name for Garrison. And it was clear the signature the Dallas Sheriff's Office had on its altered statement was even close to hers. And that's the problem when you're dealing with officials who are involved in the conspiracy. So obviously Garrison actually cared about finding the truth. Now, as a district attorney, he knew how to weigh the evidence. The implications of her experience were profound. First of all, Mercer's observations provide further evidence there was another rifleman on the Nolan head of the president. But it also, the responses to her statements are even more chilling. They prove that law enforcement officials recognized early on that a conspiracy existed to kill the president. Both local and federal authorities had altered Mercer's statements precisely to conceal that fact. Jim Garrison also made a remark about the Warren Report. He said the 26 volumes is a domestic intelligence accomplishment. Now, what he did was make a major effort to put this in front of the American people. And he was blocked at every step of the way by federal officials who did not want anyone to know the federal government was involved in the assassination. Now, there was another key witness who had actually trained Oswald as a pilot in the Civil Air Patrol. His name was David Ferry. And just as Garrison's investigation was getting started, his star witness died a convenient and very suspicious death. Now, David Ferry was a very strange man. Nobody can deny that. He was a homosexual during a macho period in history. But he was an excellent pilot with tons of bravado, and that came in handy when you're flying guns into Cuba on covert missions. Also well-connected, being both investigator and private pilot for Carlos Marcello. He was the crime boss of Texas and Louisiana. And as shown in Oliver Stone's JFK, Ferry actually predicted his own death. After he was publicly named as an accused of conspiracy in the JFK assassination by the New Orleans District Attorney's Office, he exploded at Jim Garrison's aide, Lou Avon, and said, and I quote, "You know what this news story does to me, don't you? I'm a dead man. From here on, believe me, I'm a dead man." On the same day that Ferry died, Garrison also lost another key witness, and a Castro-Cuban Eladio de Valle, who was murdered in Miami. Another coincidence, of course. His key witnesses were dropping like flies, and he knew it. He said, "All I know is that the witnesses with vital evidence in the case are bad insurance risk." Well, Ferry had connections, documented connections, with Oswald and Guy Bannister. Coroner ruled his death was a natural cause, a brain aneurysm from a cerebral hemorrhage. But they also found two suicide notes in his apartment. Typed suicide notes. Garrison's office found that rather strange and suspected poisoning. And with some dry wit and sarcasm, District Attorney made a couple of comments about another amazing coincidence. He said, "I suppose it could be a weird coincidence that on the night that Ferry penned two suicide notes, he actually died of natural causes." Now, both of those so-called suicide notes were typed, undated, and unsigned. And the last person to see him alive reported he was in good spirits. Others reported his mood was combative, intent on fighting the charges against him. Probably not supportive of the suicide theory. And those notes weren't really suggestive of suicide. Instead, they were diatribes about things he was angered by, written by a man who knew he was going to be killed. They appear instead to be two notes written by a man who knew he was leaving this world, and they were more the words of a man who was making his final statement. One note to his best friend started out, "When you read this, I'll be quite dead. No answer to be possible." And it ended with the words, "So you sowed, as you sowed, so you shall reap." Another letter started out, "To leave this life to me is a sweet prospect." And it complained about the justice system and ended with, "All the state needs is evidence to support a conviction. If this is justice, then justice be damned." So really, they're not suicide notes, even though they were called that by the investigating officers. A lot of people thought Ferry was murdered, and among those authorities was Aaron Kahn, managing director of the Metropolitan Crime Commission of New Orleans. He said the whole thing seemed to be a little bit too convenient to him. Now, another very well-known witness who was silenced was none other than Dorothy Kilgallen, the nationally famous reporter who interviewed Jack Ruby in prison. She told her editor she was going to blow the Kennedy assassination wide open. But she died of unexplained causes. Actually, the causes were explained. They just didn't make any sense. Kilgallen was a nightmare for the government because she said she was sure the assassination of JFK was a conspiracy. And she wouldn't let the story die. She vowed to stay on the case till she broke it. And she would indeed solve the case and prove the conspiracy was a result of the inside information she had acquired. Now, that claim had a very solid foundation. She's the only reporter in the country who's allowed to have a private interview with Jack Ruby. And nobody knew what he told her. So when Kilgallen said she's going to blow the case wide open, everybody paid attention. And it's easy to see how that probably disturbed a lot of people in Washington. She said it'd all be in her new book that exposed the conspiracy behind the assassination. But that book was not ever published the way she intended because she was found dead. Found in her bed in her ritzy multi-level Manhattan townhome, the victim of an alleged overdose. Having combined sleeping pills and alcohol, she succumbed to their efforts and died. So, people had a choice, either accidental overdose or suicide. But there's a bit of a problem with that official scenario. It was medically estimated Dorothy had the equivalent of 15 to 20 pills in her body. Triple combination of Nimbitol, Secanol, and Tylenol, combined with alcohol, would supercharge the effects. Now, it's been established she was observed in a fine, coherent state a short time before her death occurred. She could not have taken that many pills, accidentally or otherwise, and still been walking around in a coherent state. So whatever happened, happened very quickly. An even larger issue is the sterility of the crime scene. No vomit, no mess of any kind. And that wouldn't have been possible if she'd have swallowed 15 to 20 pills and combined them with alcohol. And you don't take that many pills accidentally. And she was very happy that night, not the slightest bit suicidal. That's why some folks think she would slip the fast-acting Mickey Finn cocktail, because a short time later she was down and down for the count. Whoever staged the crime, though, made some mistakes. The bed where she was found was actually the master bedroom. But all her friends knew that the master bedroom was never used and contained a bed that she would never have gone to sleep in. Just for show. It was off the living room, and when entertaining formally, was just used to maintain the false pretense that she and her husband were still a happy couple. Found in bed with a book next to her like she'd been reading and passed out. But the clothes she was wearing was something that friends and family both knew she never wore to bed. A blue bed jacket over a nightgown instead of her regular old pajamas. And even though she was supposedly ready for bed, she still had on her makeup and false eyelashes. Two more things family and friends knew she never wore to bed. And Kilgallen's hairdresser, who discovered the body, explained it to a friend. When I tell you the bed she was found in and how they found her, you're going to know she was murdered. And the book that was placed next to her on the bed was another mistake. It was a book that she had already read and discussed with friends. So they should have picked a book she hadn't read yet. Also, I used reading glasses when she read, and there were no reading glasses around. So there were a number of mistakes the killers would have no way to know they were making. Another thing was the air conditioner was left on, something she never did at night. When they ran lab tests on the drinking glass that was near the bed, it only showed traces of one barbiturate. But the autopsy showed she was killed by a cocktail of small doses of three different barbiturates, which formed a lethal combination when coupled with alcohol. So somebody obviously tried to make it look like she'd taken some pills, gone to bed, and quietly passed away. But if that's the case, how did the other two barbiturates get into her body? And another little gem that should have raised eyebrows, all Dorothy's notes on JFK for her upcoming book were gone. If that's not bizarre enough, Dorothy Kilgallen was a sharp individual. She was aware that two other reporters who had been investigating Kennedy's murder died sudden and strange deaths, so she usually carried JFK's notes with her. Also gave a backup copy of those notes to somebody she knew she could trust, fellow journalist Flo Pritchard. Well, guess what? 2 days later, Flo Pritchard's dead. And in the case that's not crazy enough for you, the backup copy of the notes also disappeared. People pointed out that her friend had a long-term illness, and that was true, but what happened to the notes? Never been explained. So Kilgallen's book went to publish posthumously without the chapter on JFK she worked so hard to put together. Well, it's interesting. We had another witness by the name of Lee Bowers who could have proved it was a conspiracy. He also conveniently died. We're going to talk more about him tomorrow. We're not out of time for today. So until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.